This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Jonathan Kaplan describes himself as a medical vagabond. He has worked in war zones in northern Iraq, Namibia, and Burma. He's treated the sick in South African townships, served as a ship's doctor, and as a hospital surgeon in England. Now he's studying occupational medicine and stress-related illness. Dr. Kaplan has written a new memoir called The Dressing Station, A Surgeon's Chronicle of War and Medicine. Kaplan grew up in South Africa, where his parents both practiced medicine. His father spent 5 years in the South African military, treating casualties in field hospitals. The apartheid system was in place when Kaplan was studying medicine at Cape Town University. A student anti-apartheid demonstration presented him with his first casualties and his first cause.
When we heard that there was a demonstration in the middle of Cape Town city that had ended up in a confrontation between the police and students, people were asked to go and make their presence felt so that hopefully the police wouldn't arrest everybody. I went down with a small group of other students, and we arrived there to find the confrontation lines drawn up on the steps of the cathedral in Cape Town. Shortly after the police charged, it became clear that they were not prepared to tolerate any form of protest, and they used quite a lot of violence in trying to disperse the students. Quite a lot of people were arrested, were beaten. Some of us were forced back inside the cathedral itself, and then the doors were locked from the outside, preventing us escaping. It was while standing shocked and feeling completely helpless inside this huge, gloomy space with people sobbing on the floor and crying from tear gas and bleeding from wounds, that a friend of mine, somebody whom I didn't actually know very well at the time, started helping the injured and asked me to assist. And I suppose that was the first time that I realized that I could do something useful. I discovered that a little bit of will, a little bit of ability could make a big difference amongst people who were confused and despairing and who didn't seem to have any idea of what to do themselves. I must say, had it not been for my colleague, I wouldn't have known what to do.
What did you have to do?
I had to hold bits of rolled up cloth against gashes in heads and stop them bleeding. It wasn't very complicated, but it made a difference. It gave an appearance of order, of that something was being done. It helped to motivate people. It helped people to get over the shock and dislocation of being baton charged and beaten and discovering their own vulnerability. And it had very much the same effect for me.
Over the years, you've performed complicated surgeries, often in very makeshift situations, in third world countries, in war zones. The first patient that you operated on in a hospital near the edge of Cape Town was a situation where you thought you might faint. What caused you to feel like you might faint?
Every time I've ever been in the situation of dealing with people who are very severely injured, I've felt queasy no matter how many operations I've done, no matter how much blood I've seen flow. I opened the belly of a young man that had 2 bullet holes in him. It was the first time I'd ever opened somebody's abdomen. I had no idea or assurance that I'd be able to deal with what I saw in there. I was absolutely terrified. And when I looked into this incomprehensible mess of torn tissue and blood, I really did feel that I might faint. The people who were there, the operating theatre sister, the anaesthetist, looked at me and said, "Well, you better carry on. If you don't do something, this guy's going to die." And I discovered that in a situation like that, one does the best one can. And it has to suffice because there's nobody else sometimes present to take over, to defer to, who will take control. And that was a very important realization for me. A short while later, the registrar, the surgical registrar who was my superior, turned up and took over the operation. But I had, in the meantime, been able to stop the bleeding and been able to prevent this young man dying. And that was an experience that was probably one of the most significant of my life.
Now, this was in South Africa, which is where you're from. You had thought of staying in South Africa, but to stay, you would have been drafted into the army. You left South Africa 6 days before you were supposed to report to the military. What year was this, and what would having served in the military have meant then?
It was in 1979. I would have gone into the army for 2 years, during which I might have been a doctor, but I would have been wearing the uniform. I would have then been eligible for call-up for duty for 3 months a year for the following 12 years. I would, I'm sure, have found that under some circumstances I would have been expected or ordered to do things that I wouldn't have approved of.
Like what?
Well, it's impossible to tell, but the experience that made me decide not to go into the army was that of my friend and colleague who was a year ahead of me at medical school and who had gone to the army there for a year in advance of me. He was posted to the northern border of Namibia, which was then Southwest Africa, where the South African army was fighting a fairly aggressive war into Angola. He was posted to a forward position on the border. A prisoner was brought in who was wounded, and he was asked to stabilize the man, who was then taken off for interrogation. At some point, he was called by the special police unit who were interrogating this man and instructed to revive the prisoner who had passed out because they hadn't got all the information from him that they required. My friend noticed that the man had been tortured, and he realized that he might well die. When he objected, the officer in charge of the special police unit said, "We don't care. We don't take prisoners." And he made a decision to inject the patient with something that would stop his heart.
So the doctor ended up intentionally killing the patient rather than reviving him, only to have him subjected to torture. Did the doctor think that eventually this patient was going to be tortured to death anyways, and he wanted to spare him that?
That was made explicit by the people carrying out the torture.
Well, that they would end up killing him?
Yeah, they said they didn't take prisoners.
So this is what you wanted to avoid, being used as a doctor to help in torture?
I wanted to avoid being put in situations of such moral extremity. I did not want to be faced as a person, as a human being, with situations like that.
It's interesting. You've performed surgery in several war zones, and yet you refused to serve in the military of South Africa. Obviously, it wasn't because of fear, because you've been in pretty terrifying situations voluntarily. You left South Africa, went to England, and worked there in the emergency room of a hospital. One of the really significant cases there for you is the case of an elderly diabetic woman who had been mistreated for constipation. What condition was she in when you saw her?
I would point out that I'd been by then in England for some years, moving up the surgical career ladder, and was quite an experienced surgeon with a certain amount of responsibility. I only spent a year in the emergency room. This was 4 years later when I was working in under different circumstances as the surgeon in charge at a hospital over a weekend. This patient came in. She was extremely unwell. She evidently had peritonitis, an infection inside the abdominal cavity from the leakage of bowel contents. Being a diabetic, her response to infection was poor because that's part of the spectrum of the effects of diabetes. And I carried out a very quick, simple operation to stop the infection spreading, to clean out her abdomen, and to prevent there being further leakage into the abdominal cavity. She then was taken to the intensive care unit, where she was hooked up to monitors and intravenous drips and catheters and ventilators, and the hope was that she might survive. Unfortunately, she developed a complication which is dreaded by all doctors, which is a condition called disseminated intravascular coagulopathy, a situation where the clotting factors in the blood become used up and the patient starts to bleed from every surface, every raw surface, from drip sites, from the gastrointestinal tract, from the gums. And the option that I was presented with was either having her bleed to death or carrying out what was in effect heroic surgery. She was bleeding from a large ulcer in her stomach, and what the only option that I had was to remove part of her stomach. I carried out that operation. Unfortunately, it was, and had I had the experience, I would probably have known this in advance, it was impossible to operate in a situation where every surface bled as soon as one touched it. And she died shortly after leaving the operating table. That was a very distressing experience, because it was the first time that I clearly saw that a decision that I had made had resulted in my actions causing the death of a patient.
But it sounds like she would have died had you not performed the surgery too.
Perhaps she would have, but that isn't the argument that prevails among surgeons.
So what impact did it have on you to lose a patient like that?
It made me reconsider the decisions I'd made, the circumstances that had brought me through my surgical training to the stage of moving up the career system. It seemed suddenly that every decision I'd ever made in the past had just been the result of luck, that it had turned out correctly, and that probably I shouldn't be subjecting humanity to my incompetent skills. At the same time, I did realize that I'd learned an awful lot in those years, that I'd acquired skills that I couldn't really apply anywhere else, and that, if nothing else, what I had become was somebody who was familiar with death in its various forms, and that one of the roles that was expected of me by my patients, that I would somehow intercede on their behalf with death, that I'd try and hold death at bay. I don't know whether that was a reasonable idea, but at the time it seemed very significant. It seemed one of the responsibilities that I couldn't sidestep, and so in the end I decided to stay within the career of surgery.
My guest is Dr. Jonathan Kaplan, author of the new memoir, The Dressing Station. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Dr. Jonathan Kaplan. He's written a new memoir called The Dressing Station, A Surgeon's Chronicle of War and Medicine. You eventually left hospitals. You did all kinds of things afterwards, as we'll discuss. What were your problems then with being in the hospital? Was your personal fear that you'd lose more patients, or did you have a problem with the system itself?
I think that I had reached a position where there was a likely road ahead of me, and that was that I'd become an attending surgeon with a hospital post, a secure hospital post. That was what I'd been working towards all that time, and I had never doubted that that was where I'd end up. At the same time, I realized that as soon as I took that step, I'd effectively be doing that for the rest of my life, that this point that I was at was probably the last opportunity in my life when I'd have some flexibility. I'd be able to take a short detour, as I saw it then, from the career path. I did so, and I went off to work in Africa. The experiences that I had there introduced me to a whole lot of ideas, or reintroduced me to a whole lot of ideas that I'd had about medicine, that I'd had about the reason for being a doctor.
Like what?
And I suppose ideas of being useful, of serving, of being adaptable, or something that I must have gleaned from the conversations with my father and our family medical friends who had served in the Second World War, that there was some concept of service, that there was something out in the world, a huge reservoir of suffering that we all should be doing something to alleviate.
Where did you work when you returned to Africa?
At first, I worked in Namibia, now independent, the South Africans having left. And I worked as a medical officer on a government survey that was entering areas of the northern Namibian border that had been sealed off by the South African army for 15 years. They were conducting a survey of an area that had once been a demarcated game reserve to see whether there were any animals left and whether the indigenous people who'd lived there, the known as the Bushmen, the Basarwa, still survived. I then went and worked in Zululand, where I was reminded very, very abruptly about the wildness of African medicine, because the pathology that would come in through the doors of that hospital was strange and wondrous and unlike things that one sees in the West, except in perhaps the most extreme emergency room circumstances, perhaps in the wildest and most depressed inner city areas. But the stuff that came into that Zululand emergency room and into that hospital was such a parade of suffering and strangeness that I have never seen the like.
As you write in your book, the problems that you were typically seeing then in Africa are problems that were either eradicated or unknown in other parts of the world. And I guess one example of what you're talking about is the kind of parasites that you saw. Would you describe that?
The thing that is most striking when one starts working in Africa, encountering African medicine, is the range of intestinal parasites that affect just about everybody in the continent, especially the poor. The Ascaris worm is a particularly nasty example that always made me nauseated. It can grow up to a foot long, and it forms dense knots inside the intestinal tract that can cause obstruction. It is so well suited to living inside the human body that small changes in temperature, such as a fever caused from some other source, makes it prefer to relocate, and it'll crawl out of a nostril or a mouth or other places. And the appearance of a worm from somebody's nose is one of the things that I find most disturbing.
How do you treat it?
It can be treated by doses of something like piperazine, which is a compound that kills worms. If there are knots of worms forming obstruction, it's necessary to open the abdomen sometimes and remove those worms, in other words, by surgery.
When you were working in Zululand, you also saw a lot of medicine men, Sangoma. Did you work with them?
The relationship was a strange and tangential one. We got their patients, they got our patients. We sometimes were consulted by them, although the way that they'd come was that they'd turn up in the outpatient department with a list of complaints, asking for medication for each of those complaints. We'd supply the tablets, they'd write down what the tablets were for, and then go off presumably to grind up those tablets and incorporate them in compounds that they would feed to their patients who consulted them for similar symptoms, which seemed perfectly reasonable. And we felt that if we could establish a level of trust with them, perhaps they'd send us patients that they felt they couldn't deal with.
And did they do that?
Well, it was never that clear. People did turn up who'd previously seen the Sangomas. In some cases, they turned up because of the consequences of the medication, of the treatment that the Sangomas had given them. These might be quite mild, like making small cuts in the area of a painful part of the body, and then herbs would be rubbed into those. They might become infected, causing the person to turn up in the hospital. Or they also used to use enemas of a bush called Senecia, which has a very damaging effect on the liver and could cause irreversible liver failure, in which case we'd get children, usually, who'd been given Senecia enemas, and we'd look after them, trying hopefully to improve their liver function, but often that wasn't possible.
What kind of regard did you have for the medicine men? Did you have faith in them? Did you think that they were, that any of them were charlatans, or did you feel that they were really doing their best, even though they were using techniques that were different than the ones you would use?
That's a very difficult question to answer. While there is an enormous importance socially and in the maintenance of cultural cohesiveness in societies played by traditional healers who are often spirit intermediaries between the ancestors and the people, the problem of their concept of disease, of pathology, when it came to physical illness, was quite different from ours. Often they'd be very effective in dealing with depression and psychological and psychiatric problems in their own way. But it was difficult because of the uncertainty of the symptoms that we were treating and the symptoms that they were treating. Subsequently, there's been a much greater tendency in South Africa towards working together with traditional healers, and I'm sure that a lot of information has been exchanged that has been most beneficial to both parties.
Dr. Jonathan Kaplan's new memoir is called The Dressing Station, A Surgeon's Chronicle of War and Medicine. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Dr. Jonathan Kaplan. In his new memoir, The Dressing Station, A Surgeon's Chronicle of War and Medicine, he writes about practicing medicine in war zones, in South African townships, and in a British hospital. Kaplan grew up in South Africa, where he studied medicine. You write in your book that you felt more useful working in Africa than you did working in regular hospitals, but that you were aware of an obscure guilt about practicing this kind of medicine. What were you guilty about?
What I discovered, the thing that I discovered working in Africa, and particularly working in this underfunded hospital that was on the edge of a continent of horrific diseases and that collected a huge amount of severe trauma of people injured, in political struggles, of people injured by criminal acts, of people injured as a result of hard labor in the sugarcane fields, was that a small amount of medicine makes a big difference when one's working with people who are very deprived. But the feeling of fulfillment that I was getting from it, even in a way an increased feeling of my own humanity, came at a price, because these people generally were suffering the consequences of deprivation, of cruelty, of suffering forced upon them by the actions of others, of other human beings. And it seemed to me a source of guilt that I should be finding my fulfillment through human suffering enforced by other people. There's something distressing about feeling that one has chosen to work in the proximity of suffering, and even perhaps in the proximity of evil in some cases, in order to justify one's professional and personal existence.
On the other hand, you went to places like this because you didn't want to turn your back to suffering. You wanted to be of service.
That's correct.
So you left Africa eventually, but you left Africa and then went to Kurdistan with a human rights medical group that works in international situations and war zones. Why, after leaving Africa, did you go to a war zone?
Because human motivation is never clear-cut, and I had achieved and discovered something, some opportunity for self-realization, some form of fulfillment in Africa that I no longer felt when I got back into a conventional hospital post, when I was asked whether I'd be prepared to work in northern Iraq during the Kurdish uprising at the end of the Gulf War. I volunteered because I was trying to find out more about that situation and about the circumstances, the insight that I'd gained in these extreme situations.
Would you describe the refugee camp that you worked in there?
When I arrived in northern Iraq, the Kurdish uprising was collapsing. The Kurdish Peshmerga fighters were retreating. Millions, that is 2 million Kurdish civilians, were on their way fleeing towards the borders of the country to northwards to Turkey and eastwards to Iran. I arrived on the Turkish-Iraqi border as huge numbers of refugees began to cross the mountains over the snowfields and try to enter Turkey. They were prevented from crossing by the Turkish military, who had been fighting their own undeclared war against their own Kurdish population for 10 years, quite a ruthless war, and had absolutely no wish to allow Iraqi Kurds to come onto Turkish soil. So the people were trapped up on the borderline in gullies and rocks on the mountainsides, where they died of exposure and dysentery and altitude sickness, and where I arrived initially with no equipment, no personnel. I was traveling on my own. I'd been separated from the rest of my party. And I walked through this refugee camp, seeing suffering that I could do nothing to alleviate, seeing people die that I couldn't save, seeing a migration of people the like of which I'd never encountered before. And it was an experience of utter helplessness. It was very, very distressing.
You had no tools to help. You had no medical equipment with you.
None whatsoever.
Were there things that you could do to improvise?
With 400,000 people.
Right. Right. You write that in Kurdistan you became aware of the perverse seduction of war. What is that seduction?
There is a clarity to life, to understanding things, that comes in a place where everything depends on one's decision-making and one's survival and that of one's patients depends on the way in which you see problems and you see solutions. There is none of the insidious dread that goes with dealing with daily issues like mortgages and pensions and careers and property. Life is the way life looks, and there is a freedom associated with that that, of course, is also partly coloured by the possibility of immediate and rather violent death or disfigurement. It's not a very healthy situation, and it's not a very pure pleasure, because fear is very unpleasant and it's often very frightening. But there is some quality of insight that I've had in places like that that I've never found anywhere else in my life.
Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us about your work. Thank you.
My pleasure, Terry. Thank you.
Jonathan Kaplan's new memoir is called The Dressing Station, A Surgeon's Chronicle of War and Medicine. He's now studying occupational medicine and stress-related illness. This is Fresh Air.